Welcome to Media Confidential. Today, the eyes of the world are back on Israel and the war in Gaza after the drone attack by Iran at the weekend. But while war rages in Gaza, what's happening in the West Bank is alarming.
To shed light on what has become essentially a sealed-off zone, we're going to be joined by the award-winning journalist and columnist for Haaretz, Gideon Levy. He's been writing his weekly column, The Twilight Zone, since the First Intifada, so that's 1987. He writes about the plight of those living in the occupied territories, and he's one of few voices regularly on the ground in the West Bank. We'll hear how the attacks of October the 7th have affected those living in the region around 100 kilometres north of Gaza.
This is Media Confidential, your weekly dive behind the headlines and beyond the clickbait as we seek to discover the heart of the story in the rapidly shifting media landscape. I'm Alan Rusbridger, editor of Prospect magazine here in London.
And I'm Lionel Barber, also in London. Alan, we're both online today.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened, but once again, you're more smartly dressed than I. You put a jacket on, especially for the occasion. I approve of that.
No tie, though.
No tie. It's dressed down Tuesday. We are recording on Tuesday because I'm the one that's travelling tomorrow. I'm going off to Perugia, the journalism festival, which I think is not very sunny.
Well, good luck there. And please, just check on your Italian, because you need to keep the flag flying. You know, this is Media Confidential. Confidaziona, anyway.
Very good, very good. So what have you been monitoring this week, Lionel, from your vantage point in London?
Well, I'm going to come back to America because there's two very interesting media stories. The first is a very long piece in the Wall Street Journal talking about the attempt by the management and the executive editor, Joe Kahn, to quash what they call a revolt in the newsroom. And Alan, the intro to the article is to die for. It says, "The New York Times is investigating itself." Now, the serious point is that Joe Kahn has licensed this. He wants to know who are the moles in the New York Times newsroom who've been linking information about that report that you and I talked about when we interviewed A.G. Sulzberger, the publisher of the New York Times, which was a report, well-documented, well-sourced, of mass violence perpetrated by the Hamas terrorists and attackers went on October the 7th against women. And the anonymous source in the New York Times had complained about the quality of reporting and the sourcing, but also, crucially, that, you know, what about the plight of the Gazans? This is not balanced coverage. And Joe Kahn has given an interview, very rare interview for an editor to the journal, saying, you know, this is offside. We can't have people in the newsroom second-guessing editorial decisions.
I read the piece in the Wall Street Journal, and it was gracious enough to concede that these kind of debates are happening in most newsrooms, including the Wall Street Journal.
Well, that's where I come to the other story, which is that the NPR, National Public Radio, a senior editor, Uri Berliner, has been suspended for complaining about bias and a lack of rigor at NPR. Now, he's a very experienced journalist. He wrote an open letter in the media criticizing NPR, talking about sorry levels of trust and declining ratings. Sounds a bit like what people say about the BBC. But anyway, Berliner has been controversially suspended.
Interesting stuff.
What about you, Alan? What have you been looking at?
Well, so there was a tweet from Mark Urban, the respected security defense correspondent on Newsnight, announcing that he was stepping back from Newsnight because they were making redundancies as they go to a new format. And he had an outpouring of love on Twitter, which he was clearly quite moved by. But I think it is a moment for the BBC. This decision to downgrade Newsnight to essentially a talking show. And I must admit that I was sad because I think Mark Urban is a really remarkable and informed journalist in that region, the area that he knows about. And it feels to me a loss of talent by the BBC, a loss of experienced talent. And I know that Newsnight has been slowly eroded over the years. But it's quite a big statement to be losing journalists of that caliber. And the response, I thought, was remarkable, really.
Yeah, I know Mark's work. I've much admired him. As you say, he really does know his stuff. He's got excellent sources on the defence and security beat. He's been doing it, by the way, for more than 30 years. He's been the face, in some ways, of the Newsnight programme alongside the presenters. And my question, Alan, because I agree with you that it's a big, serious loss of experiences, why didn't the BBC try and persuade him to take a senior reporting job overall for the BBC so you could preserve that talent and knowledge, institutional memory?
Maybe they did. We don't know. But whatever it is, it's a big loss. And I hope it wasn't just for budgetary reasons. But and the other big departure of the week was Henry Winter from The Times. Now, Henry Winter is a big name sports writer, was hired with great fanfare by The Times, I think about 7 or 8 years ago. And he was made redundant, along with a lot of male journalists from the sports department who are restructuring, although they've announced that they're going to be restructuring, that there will be redundancies. This comes on the wake of the New York Times effectively closing down its whole sports department and replacing it with content from The Athletic, which a separate digital publication.
They paid a lot of money for that, Alan, didn't they?
And I just wonder what that's all about. Henry Winter was I'm sure he was expensive too, but he was a big name hire for The Times, and it seems quite a statement to be losing him.
Well, I confess, Alan, I am a Henry Winter fan. I've read him always because he writes wonderful match reports with context. He's a very fine journalist. So I'd be looking at, you know, asking why did he have to go? And by the way, if they do anything about Michael Atherton, who is equally world-class cricket writer, former England captain, but he can write.
But Martin Samuel is a very good writer. They are expensive, these big-name writers. On the FT, you weren't troubled by this. I think you had Matthew Engel occasionally writing, but you weren't known for your sports coverage.
Oh, well, we had people queuing up to go to the World Cup.
Not the same thing.
What we didn't do is having nightly news reports. We did have a sports page, by the way, about 20 years ago, but it didn't last very long.
Did you ruthlessly axe it?
I think it axed itself, actually, but I certainly would have done, because the chief proponents of the sports page, I think, were last seen in a tracksuit aged 8. They were much better at economics and public policy, Alan.
I'll take your word for it.
Still expensive, though.
They are, the big-name sports writers are expensive, as I know, only too well.
Alan, I'm slightly surprised that you haven't picked the biggest media story of the week, which is Liz Truss, getting enormous coverage all over the place. Spectator here, Alison Pearson at The Telegraph. I mean, at this point, I'm wondering why she's not going to be turning up at Prospect. She's being serenaded, even though she's talking, spouting nonsense about the deep state, which she equates the Financial Times with. And you know, I mean, it's the most pitiful lack of self-consciousness. And she honestly thinks, you know, it's unfinished business. She could be back.
Well, I'm obviously losing it not to have given over a special edition of Prospect. There was one thing that reminded me. I don't know if you remember a man called Bob Edwards. Who edited Daily Mirror, Daily Express. I think he edited 3 or 4 titles. And there was a story about him being driven. He was in a hurry to get to lunch one day. He was in his Rolls Royce or his grand car being driven down Fleet Street. And a pedestrian suddenly runs in front of the car and gets knocked down. And Bob Edwards is supposed to have got out of the car and said, "Why does this always happen to me?" And there's a similar line in Liz Truss, when she goes to see the Queen promptly dies, and Liz Truss's first reaction is, "Why me?" It's a very solipsistic memoir. Even more solipsistic than most memoirs.
Follow Media Confidential wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on X, formerly Twitter, where we're at MediaConfPod, and we'd love to hear your comments and views on the show. Iran's mass drone and missile attack on Israel at the weekend ushered in a new and dangerous phase in the regional conflict. And while the rest of the world waits to see how Israel responds, there is one area of the occupied territories that's been ignored for the past few months, and that's the West Bank. The reality is that life for the 3 million people living there has become intolerable.
All the Palestinian cities and villages in the West Bank have been sealed off. There are about 150,000 Palestinians living in the West Bank who were permitted to work in Israel, but since the attacks on the 7th of October, they've not been allowed to do so, and nor is the rest of the population allowed to work on their own farmland.
But perhaps more shocking is the death toll. Up to the end of February, 396 people had been killed in the West Bank since the October the 7th attacks at the hands of Israeli soldiers. That figure has come from carefully checked data from the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem. 100 of the victims were children or youngsters. Now add to that figure the mass arrests. Some 4,785 people were arrested in the West Bank between October and December, according to the UN. And you have a zone that is quietly being changed beyond recognition, away from the glare of the world's media.
The award-winning journalist Gideon Levy has continued to visit the West Bank for a weekly column in Haaretz since the war broke out. He's covered life in the occupied territory since the late 1980s, and we're joined by Gideon now. So we're very privileged to be joined now by Gideon Levy, who has been for many years a columnist on Haaretz. And Gideon, we were both impressed by a recent piece that you wrote about the underreported story of what's going on in the West Bank. But perhaps we could just set some context. For most Israelis, what is their media consumption and how much direct reporting would they experience from the West Bank, the occupied territories?
Throughout the years, the coverage of the occupation, not only the West Bank, it's also Gaza. The coverage of the occupation was maybe the most shameful coverage in Israeli media, which is a very good media and courageous and independent and free and has very little censorship. But when it comes to the occupation as a general, there is a rare coalition in Israeli society in which nobody wants to tell and nobody wants to know. And everyone is happy about the situation in which there is no coverage. And if there is a coverage, it is always very biased, mainly dehumanizing the Palestinians systematically over the years and framing the occupation in a very specific framework, which enabled the Israelis to feel so good about themselves and to live in peace with the occupation. It's a service that the Israeli media is providing the Israeli population, namely, feel good with yourself, go with the occupation and see without it. And this is going on now for decades, but it's getting worse and worse. It got to its peak in this war, because the coverage of Gaza in this war was the most shameful ever. I will not get into it because it's not exactly our subject tonight, but I can just tell you that an average Israeli saw nothing of the suffer of Gaza, of the starvation, of the dying children, of the destruction. He saw almost nothing.
So can you, again, for the listeners who won't know so much about your work, can you just fill us in on how you've kept a consistent searchlight on the West Bank and the occupied territories? You live, I know, in Tel Aviv, but you have been traveling to these areas all your career, really.
Yeah, for the last 36 years, I think, there was almost no week in which I didn't go to the occupied territories. I'm a son of a German Jew, so order should be, it's always on the same day, by the way. Not very journalistic, but it's always on the same day. It used to be on Sundays. In the last 15 years, it's on Mondays. The main issue is that in the last 16 years, I can't go to Gaza because of Israeli restrictions, which made my job, my career, and my personal feeling very, very bad, because I'm very attached to Gaza, and Gaza was the main source of my stories. And I love to go there, even though it's a very tough place. But I'm not there for the last 16 years. So I focus on the West Bank, and I go every week.
Just pause there and explain why you couldn't go to Gaza.
Because Israel decided that no Israeli will be able to enter Gaza. Ever since Hamas took power, under the very hollow excuse that Israel is protecting us, and another excuse is that we might become hostages in Hamas hands, Israeli journalists, and then Israel will have to pay a price to release us. I'm not sure Israel would have paid any price to release me, but that's not exactly the issue now. The issue is that we were prevented. By the way, we even appealed to the Supreme Court, my newspaper did, but it didn't help us much. And it's very convenient to everybody, because most of the Israeli journalists have no interest to go to Gaza. So it's really only few of us who really think that you can't be a journalist without being there. In any case, ever since I can't go there, and it, as I said, it's so many years now, I focus on the West Bank, and it's always a micro story. It's always one crime of the occupation. People tend to think that I'm writing about the Palestinians. Not at all. I'm writing about us, Israelis, about what we are doing there. And I try to rehumanize the Palestinians, to bring the stories of the crimes and to document them and to give them face and names and some kind of human attributes. It's a whistle in the darkness. I don't know how many people have interest in it. I am lucky enough to have Haaretz who still believes in it. But let me tell you, it's not the most well-read stories in Haaretz.
Gideon, reading your dispatches and your commentary, it's really harrowing what you've written. You've written with great economy and restraint. But I think it would be useful for you to just give a sense of what is happening on the ground in this area that you described as shuttered and besieged by the Israelis, by the settlers.
The last half a year was the great opportunity of the settlers to go wild. Not that before they had some restraints, but under the cover of the war in Gaza, it is much easier for them to do what they are doing throughout the years, but with less restraints even than before. The West Bank changed the last half a year in a way that anyone who travels there wouldn't recognize it. Very few Israelis go there, so they don't know what am I talking about. But the settlers know, and the Palestinians know, how the West Bank changed in this half a year under the darkness of the war. Nobody pays attention now. The main focus is on Gaza, and the West Bank turned into really an impossible place. And it differs between the authorities, the army, and the settlers. Doing everything, obviously, together, simultaneously, the soldiers are supporting the settlers, guarding them, and many times also collaborating with them. But it has so many different expressions. First of all, the West Bank got back to the days of the Second Intifada, namely that moving from one place to another in the West Bank became almost impossible. I have a friend whose mother died now in the age of 105. He lives in Tulkarem. There is the tradition of coming to pay condolences to the families who lost somebody. He knew that nobody will make it into Turkharem. Turkharem is quite a big city in the West Bank. He knew that no Palestinians will be able to get there. So he declared that he will be for one day in Ramallah instead of 4 days of mourning, and he will accept the guests there because Ramallah is a little bit more open. But even to get to Ramallah or to any place, they closed most of the roads and most of the gates. You have to know that Israel, one of its inventions, is being able to lock all the villages and towns in the West Bank within minutes. They put gates everywhere, and the moment they decide to lock the West Bank, it's, you know, you take few troops with a key and go and lock the gates, that's it. And the old West Bank is in a cage. So they didn't lock all the gates and all the roads. They always left one road open to every town and every village. But, you know, life becomes impossible when there is only one road leading to a huge city like Nablus.
I remember going to Nablus in 2008. I've been to Ramallah and Jericho and other places in the West Bank on the three times I've visited Israel. But I think there's something else that you mentioned, apart from these horrifying stories and accounts of random violence by the settlers or the kind of vigilante settlers. They've got their own security forces. And this is this fact, that 150,000 West Bank Palestinians were permitted to work in Israel. Now that's completely stopped. I'd like to hear from you about what impact that's had, not just in the West Bank, but also in Israel with the loss of labor.
It's a catastrophe. There are certain fields in Israel, mainly construction more than anything else, which are really on hold because most of the workers were Palestinians. But it's nothing to compare to the Palestinian price because this was one of the very, very few sources of income. You know, if you had one worker who worked in Israel, 3-4 families would live on his income. Because he would bring home a sum of money which you can never do in the West Bank. And families, all families, you know, not only one family. Every son like this would supply 3-4 families with his income. This is gone now. Add to this something which should be also mentioned. The other nice way of income, and not only economically, but also culturally, in the West Bank are the olive trees, as you know. Israel prevented in the last half a year from almost, well, let's say most of the farmers to get to their olive trees to harvest them. The harvest is around October. They didn't let them get there to their orchards. And at least one third of the olives remained on the trees. Another source of income which has no alternative for the Palestinians. So life, on one hand, you cannot move. On the other hand, you have nowhere to move in terms of work. And on top of it, the daily pogroms of the settlers add to this the fact that at least 8,000 Palestinians were arrested in the West Bank in this half year. Most of them political prisoners, and you get a very, very frightening picture because we know where will it lead. We know we have been there already. What happens when an old people is being put in a cage, starving, or at least very poor, without anything to do, any perspective for the future? We know where it leads to.
This is Media Confidential with Alan Rusbidger and me, Lionel Barber. And after the break, we'll have more from Gideon Levy on life in the West Bank and how those living in the occupied territories are being impacted as the war looks likely to escalate. We'll be right back.
In this week's Prospect podcast, Deputy Editor Ellen Halliday is joined by Contributing Editor Tom Clark. Tom's been exploring the fate of collapsing councils as their money is running out, and what could an incoming Labour government do about the lack of funding should they be elected in the coming election.
All of this kind of history of active municipal governance can be traced back to Birmingham in the 1870s. And so it's poignant now to see that as Birmingham realises, and the particular triggers for it were specific, it had mishandled historic claims about unequal pay and that kind of thing. But really, the underlying frailty is the one that we've been talking about, shared with all the other councils. And I just saw the BBC News story and the list of things that they were doing. They're cutting the arts budget by 100%. Closing a dozen or so community centres, completely closing them. The other thing they're doing is they're cutting the number of people who are keeping an eye on fly tipping. So I just thought, you know, less music, less art, less community, and more rubbish on the streets. You know, we can see quite directly that's what's going to flow from these decisions, which is a kind of reverse version of what Joseph Chamberlain did so successfully in the 1870s. And so the question that makes you think is this place that was the cradle of creative local government in England also going to be its grave?
So follow the Prospect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're listening to that podcast, why not take out a digital subscription to Prospect and enjoy a 1 month free trial to our digital content? You'll immediately get full access to rigorously fact-checked, truly independent analysis and perspectives. There's no commitment, you can cancel at any time. And to take advantage of this offer, please visit our website or go to your favorite search engine and search for, quotes, Prospect Magazine subscription, quotes.
And now back to our chat with Gideon Levy, author of the Twilight Zone column in Haaretz.
Gideon, can I ask you whether you feel there is a conflict ever between your identity as an Israeli and your identity as a journalist? Because I know there are many people in Israel who hate you and believe you're some kind of traitor. I'd like to just explore your own feelings about how you've dealt with that conflict.
This is, Ellen, a very good question, if I may say so. I participated last night in a panel in the School of Journalism in Columbia University, New York. And I say there, and I'll tell you, that most of the Israeli journalists feel, first of all, that they are Israelis, and then that they are journalists. I see it as a total misunderstanding of being a journalist and of journalism, and the betrayal in our mission. What does it mean you are first of all an Israeli? Does it mean that you serve some kind of propaganda? Does it mean that you serve some kind of hasbara, as we call it? Does it mean that you serve some kind of ideology? Zionism, for example? We are first of all journalists, and I feel that I'm first of all a journalist and a human being, but for sure not Israeli. Because what does it mean, I'm first of all Israeli? It means that the Palestinians don't count. It means that the life of Palestinians is worth less than life of Jews. Well, where does it lead to exactly? A journalist cannot define himself neither according to national or religious lines or ideological ones. We have our mission, and our mission is to tell the truth.
But nevertheless, we saw this in the UK when the UK was under attack from the IRA, that many British journalists found it extremely hard to write objectively about that extremely violent and turbulent period of British life. Sometimes it was the foreign correspondents who could see things more clearly. I think it makes you an unusual person to have chosen this lonely path that you've chosen.
So I crossed some lines, no doubt. I've spent it physically many times in my career when I stood with the Palestinians and the Israeli soldiers were in front of me. And I asked myself, where do I belong exactly? Almost physically, yeah? Here are those soldiers who are the sons of my friends and the friends of my sons. And I stand on the other side with the Palestinians, who are usually the victims of those situations. It is not simple, but I still believe that there is something which is called objective journalism, or at least when it comes to facts, to reporting, it should be something which is clear, which is free of all kinds of ideological considerations. Then you can express your views and they can go anywhere. And I'll give you one small example. The fact that Israel or Israeli media doesn't show anything from Gaza now is a betrayal of our mission. That's the first mission of us, is to inform, and the Israeli media doesn't do it. You can be happy about the killings in Gaza. You can be devastated by this. But you have to know what's going on in Gaza, for God's sake. So same about the West Bank. I think that Israeli or not Israeli, Zionist or not Zionist, someone has to tell the story of the West Bank, of the occupation, of the crimes. And will he be Israeli or not? What does it matter? Yeah, I'm very attached to this place, and I write my stories from a certain ideological point of view, no doubt about it. But my first aim is to tell what is happening. And most of the Israeli journalists avoid it.
Have you ever had moments of self-doubt?
Unfortunately, not. And I really mean it. I really mean it. Unfortunately, not. If I have doubts when I look backwards, my doubts are always if I'm not too soft. I should have been more radical.
Gideon, this is slightly shifting the ground here, but why have the Arab-Israelis been so passive? You would have thought, given what's happening across the border in the occupied territories, there might have been a response, but it's been quite remarkable.
Lalman, they are afraid to breathe. As simple as this. They can lose everything, and they have a lot to lose. Unlikely the Palestinians in the West Bank, and in Gaza, obviously, who have very little to lose. They have a lot to lose. They can lose their jobs very easily now. They can lose their freedom very easily now. And they don't dare to breathe. It's unbelievable. Those who dare to pay any kind of empathy, nothing political, human empathy with the victims of Gaza, were either fired from their jobs, some of them were even taken to the police for interrogation, some of them were brought to justice, only for paying empathy with the victims of Gaza. Listen, I live in Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv includes also Jaffa, as you know. There's not one single family in Jaffa who does not have relatives in Gaza. What are they supposed to feel now when they see what's going on there? And they keep silent. It's pure fear. It might explode one day. It might. But right now they are paralyzed.
Gideon, I'm interested. You've talked about, when we talk about the formation of Israeli public opinion, you've said there are virtually no Israeli journalists showing up in the West Bank at the moment. What about social media? So even if the mainstream media are not showing any images of suffering from Gaza, is it your impression that Israelis are finding their own sources of information through social media? Or do you think the shock that is experienced within the nation is such that people have switched off the empathy tap?
Both. The big vast majority shut down. On the 7th of October, most of the Israelis, including a big part of what was called the peace camp, or the Zionist leftists, or the liberals, you heard it clearly by them. They said after the 7th, we finished as the Palestinians. We don't want to hear about the suffering. We are not interested to know. For us, all Gaza are terrorists. They don't deserve any empathy, any struggle. They are for us non-existing. So first of all, most of the Israelis don't want to see. So problem is solved. They don't have to look for it because they don't want to know. And even if they would know, they would tell you, no, I don't care. Let them starve, let them die. Even the children, yeah, they brought it upon themselves. I have no guilt feelings. I have no responsibility or accountability about what's going on in Gaza because they deserve it. And they brought it upon themselves. And they voted Hamas. And they are all Hamas. So that's the big vast majority. A very, very tiny and shrinking camp who is still interested can easily find. First of all, I hardly watch Israeli TV, but all the international networks can be shown here, are being shown here, and you can get a lot from international networks like Al Jazeera English, like BBC, like Sky News, like CNN. They're all doing quite a good job. Secondly, there are some very, very good leftist, real leftist websites, like a local conversation and others who bring a lot of information. But I can tell you that the demand for this kind of information is very, very limited in Israel. Very, very limited.
Can I ask you about the reaction to your work and the extent to which you pay attention to it or you're conscious of it or that you force yourself to block it out?
It's a weird situation this time. I'll be very frank with you. I don't know how to explain it. You see, in 2014, my newspaper had to hire bodyguards after an article I wrote about the Israeli pilots bombing Gaza. And then Haaretz lost hundreds of thousands of dollars because of this article and still supported me, obviously, or not obviously. This time, I feel totally secure, and I feel that in a certain stage, Israelis care less about what is being said about them, both abroad and from within. They are so convinced now that justice is with them that they don't care so much anymore. It's all kinds of lunatics like me and some leftists in the world. They care less. I see that something became very apathetic to our remarks or descriptions or opinions or attitudes. Those are not good news, obviously. And look, I don't read the talkbacks. I never read. Each time I tempt myself to read, after two talkbacks, I stop it because it's really depressing. It's really depressing. I don't know who is behind it. I don't know how many people are behind it. I had one really massive organized attack in this war, I must say, of thousands of messages, text messages in 24 hours, something crazy. And it's all really garbage of the garbage. You don't know how low people get here in expressing hatred in Israel. But by the end of the day, first of all, I must tell you the truth that I'm aiming more at the international community than at the Israeli readership. I think I'm much more read abroad, and I think it's also more important right now and more relevant.
How do you keep going? It must be a bleak place at the moment to be doing the kind of work you're doing and to feel so marginalized and not to see any political hope.
It's the darkest time ever. Because really, it's not only ideological hopes, but also personal hopes. There was always someone in Israeli politics in which I believed, in which I thought if he would only make it, things will be different. There's none right now. If you let me now push a button and decide who will be the next prime minister of Israel, I have not one name to offer you, to suggest you. It's really the darkest times ever. And I continue, maybe because of inertia, maybe because of you are young, both of you, but there is a certain age in which you try to get the most from what is left. And maybe this motivates me. I should have retired already 6 years ago, I think, and I didn't. Luckily so, and I'm very grateful for this, but I continue. I don't know. I never asked myself, oh, does it mean something or not, or is it important or not, and does it have any effect or not? You know, it's like someone who learns to sing one song, he continues to sing it. I don't know what to say about it. Really, I don't have a very good answer to this, but I have no doubts that I will continue as long as I can. I mean, I have no thoughts about stopping or changing attitude or anything. Nothing.
Well, Gideon, you're talking to two old geezers, actually. You're not young at all, but I say continue singing your song. But Gideon, just do me a favor. Don't take your own personal security for granted. Not in these times.
Look, I was shot once in my life, and this was by Israeli soldiers in the West Bank in 2006, I think. I don't remember what year. Around the second Intifada. And I was lucky enough to have, at those times, a bulletproof car. So I was saved. And ever since then, I was never really in life danger. So after so many years, we always say, me and my photographer, we are too old now to be targets.
I want to ask one final question, Gideon, because we've asked a lot about Israelis and the media they're getting. Can you answer the mirror question about Palestinians? In the Palestinians you're meeting, to what extent, where are they getting their news from? And do they have a sort of appreciation of the Israeli debate and argument that's going on within Israel? Or is it two sides that never meet?
First of all, there are two sides that never meet ever since the wall was built, ever since they need license to get into Israel, ever since Israelis are scared to go to the West Bank. They don't meet anymore. That's one of the tragedies, is that in the 90s, people still mixed. It was not a very equal mixture, but still people mixed, not anymore. Secondly, it's not a mirror because there's no symmetry, as you know. Nothing is symmetric here. But I'm the wrong person to ask this question because in the last years, I hardly met influential Palestinians. Neither politicians, nor intellectuals. I really go only to the grassroots, the victims. I'm every week with another family. And here there is something very interesting that I cannot, that I would like to share with you. Look, I'm coming to homes every week who lost their son or their father or their home or their property or were arrested just the day before, 2 days before. People went through terrible things. I was this Monday at the home of someone who lost his son 2 days before I came there by a sniper. You know, in 36 years, there was not one single time in which Palestinians wouldn't talk to me. And they know I'm Israeli. And they don't know who I am. Most of them don't know me. Those grassroots, those simple farmers, kind of places, the shepherds, that they have no idea who I am or what do I stand for. They never heard about Haaretz. They're always deeply disappointed that it's not a TV, that it's only a newspaper. And still they would always talk to me, always. And when I say talk, it's really share their emotions and share their hopes. And they always sound much more eager for different relations with the other side than the Israelis. They would, at least those whom I met, always speak about living together, while the Israelis always speak, even the leftists, about separation. So there is a national sentiment there. I can't understand how someone who was shot yesterday by an Israeli sniper is ready to talk to an Israeli journalist, who is ready to accept him in his own. Would it be the opposite way? No way it would work. And it's working for so many years. So It's not a very good answer to your question, but I can't tell you more than the fact that the grassroots are still believing in living together. They want to live with us.
Well, it's hard to know where to start after listening to Gideon Levy because, as he said, it's the blackest of pictures, almost unremitting disaster, humanitarian catastrophe in the West Bank, which is the story that nobody really is reporting on because all the focus has been on Gaza. So I think in that sense, it was extremely valuable. Alan, you did ask one of the key questions, which is, you know, how do you reconcile your feelings as an Israeli at the same time as being a reporter? And well, he's worked it out. I think a lot of people would have a lot of problems with that.
I thought his answer was a kind of model. They should teach that answer in journalism school. He approaches it with such clarity that he sees no conflict at all. He's first and foremost a journalist and a human being, and Israeli second. And his pursuit of facts and the truth trumps everything else. And I think he's got a crystal clear hope of what journalism of the sort that he does can do. It's tragic that he's such a marginalized figure feels such a marginalized figure, though maybe his reputation internationally is bigger than it is nationally. But nevertheless, he keeps doing it.
And I would say to all young journalists, if you look at Haaretz and read what he's written, there aren't lots of adjectives in his prose. It's spare prose. He really does confine himself to reporting what is happening and what people are saying. With no great sweeping judgments, it's there.
And that methodical, just returning to a place on a weekly basis to find the story and ignoring the elites and ignoring what the politicians are saying, but just going to find the human stories of people who are suffering in the way that they are, is again a sort of object lesson of what reporters can do. I thought that was a very powerful conversation, and I'm really glad that we managed to speak to him. That's all from Media Confidential. A massive thank you to Gideon Levy. We'll be back next week, and will you still be in London? I can't believe it, Alan.
Yes, I'll be fully domiciled in London for the short duration.
This is excellent. I have to start paying taxes here soon.
Don't worry, if anybody's listening from HMRC, I am definitely a packed taxpayer.
Very good.
And remember, you can send any questions or comments to mediaconfidential@prospectmagazine.co.uk or get in touch on X, that's formerly Twitter. We are at MediaConfPod. Thank you again for listening to Media Confidential, brought to you by Prospect Magazine and Fresh Air. The producer is Martin Points Roberts.
And remember to listen and follow Media Confidential wherever you get your podcasts, and join us next week for more invaluable analysis.